the story of the shows that brought entertainment to the people of Australia, touring not only from city to city, but on the road from town to town and on the track to outback settlements thousands of miles from anywhere. This is fair dinkum variety indeed, full of the pioneering spirit that founded this colony 175 years ago. In Australia, the first touring shows went out more than 100 years ago. In the decades that followed, audiences in the most remote places, as well as in the cities, applauded companies like Coles Bohemian Players, Max Varieties, Diamonds Marquee, and Barton's Follies. They got to know the circuses of Philip Worth, Soles and Perry's, and were dazzled by perhaps the greatest touring show ever, Sawley's. Although their heyday is over, the touring shows go out still today. As I speak to you now, audiences are falling under the fascination of live entertainment in three dimensions, presented before their very eyes.
5 foot two and eyes are blue, and oh, what those 5 feet can do. Has anybody seen my gal? Turned up nose, fancy clothes, never had no other bows. Has anybody seen my gal? If you should run into a 5 foot 2 covered in furs, diamond rings and all those things, bet your life that it isn't hers. And could she love, could she woo, could she coo, has anybody seen my gal?
The brash, brave, impudent sound of an entertainer under canvas. And how loyal many of the artists are to the touring theatre. There's more to this comment than defiant nostalgia.
Although I was with Coles in latter years when it was Coles Varieties, and I will say that it was one of the nicest shows on the road. And people who have never seen the tents or the canvas theater, once you play them, you don't want to play the theaters anymore, because there's everything you'd want, up to scenery, the musicians they had, all good musicians in the orchestras, the lighting was wonderful, and they used to get some wonderful audiences too.
That was comedian Bert LeBlanc, who came to Australia in 1913 for 6 months and has stayed 50 years. His tent show experience includes years with Max as well as Coles Varieties. Other veterans of touring shows are here tonight to recall their early days. One of the most successful and still an active performer is the illusionist, the great Levant.
Well, when I first started in this business as a professional, there would be at least in Australia, at least 50 touring shows. Bell ringers, I remember the Lynch family bell ringers and the Bryant bell ringers and the West Pictures and the Bretons. By that I mean they ran a half program of music and a half program of films. It was quite the thing to have companies of 4, 5, 6, or 7 people. It was a big company that had a dozen people, and go out into the country and play right through. Of course, in those days, there was no permanent cinemas. The cinemas used to tour too. Small Johnson Lundell Dynamo with a single cylinder to D an engine and some films and a projector that stand up in a hall somewhere, and away they go. A lot of those cinema shows too that toured, they also had vocalists and acts of some kind mixed in with them.
Those pioneers really got to know their audiences. One such rugged Australian was Kate Howard, who remember seeing her in Possum Paddock or perhaps Gumtree Gully. Kate Howard often played in barns in the sheep and cattle and wheat country. Comedian Reg Courtley was with her in the 20s on a tour which took them ultimately 60 miles back of Bourke.
Round about 7 o'clock, I said to Miss Howard, "Isn't it time we opened up?" And she said, "Oh, no, not yet, Reg." She said, "It's far too early." I said, "We always open the doors at 7 o'clock." She said, "Oh, yes, but not in the country." 8:30, she decided to open the door of the shed. Outside, she'd placed a table and a kerosene lamp. Inside, complete darkness, no light at all. I was still quite upset about this. As I say, it was the first time I'd been on tour. Anyway, about 10 minutes later, we heard the clippity-clop and clippity-clop and clippity-clop of a horse. Sure enough, the horseman arrived. In one hand, he had a kerosene lamp, and in the other hand, He had a wooden box. Tethered his horse, got down, and he knew Miss Howard. Miss Howard knew everybody throughout Australia, all her audiences. She knew them personally. "Hello, Miss Howard. Good evening. How much is it to go in tonight?" She looked up and down, and she said, "Well, no, 10 shillings. And, of course, in those days, 10 shillings would be about £5 to go into a theatre these days. But quite willingly, he paid his 10 shillings up and went inside. A little time later, a horse and buggy arrived. In the horse and buggy were the mum and dad and about 3 children. Each of them had a kerosene lamp. Each of them had a box or a tin. They all got off, tethered the horse again, said hello to Miss Howard, how much to go in. She looked at them, saw that they were a family. She said 10 shillings the lot.
It's worth noting, by the way, that many really big-name artists went out on the road. In 1933, the famous English male impersonator Ella Shields toured North Queensland for Stanley Mackay, another Australian pioneer showman. He recalls Ella with great affection.
She was staying at the Sea View Hotel at Townsville, and the two baggage men, they were always glad to take her trunk to her hotel, because she'd always give them a good tip. And this day, we finished the tour of Townsville this year, and they were taking her port, or her trunk, I should say, down to the truck for the last time. And one of the chaps' name was Russell. So she always called him Mr. Russell, and she slipped a note into his blazer pocket. She said, "There, Mr. Russell, divide that between you and Jules." He said, "Oh, thank you, Miss Shields." And so anyhow, they put her baggage onto the lorry, and he took the note out. He says, "Cracky," he says, "she's given us a dinner." And and Jules said, "Oh, well, I thought she'd always do something like that." So they quick and lively went into the hotel to get the change and celebrate. But before they got their change, an irate lady was rushing down the stairs. She called out, "Mr. Russell, Mr. Russell." "Yes, Miss Shields." "I gave you a £10 note. "Yes, Miss Shields." "Oh," she says, "I'm not that rich. I thought it was 10 shillings. So the millionaires, for 5 minutes, handed her back £9.10.
I'm Burlington Bertie. I rise at 10:30, then saunter along like a tall. I walk down the Strand with my gloves on my hands, and I walk down again with them off. I'm all airs and graces, correct easy paces. So long without food, I forgot where my face is. I'm Bert. Bert, I haven't a shirt, but my people are well off, you know. Nearly everyone knows me, from Smith to Lord Rosebery. I'm Burlington Bertie from Bow."
Touring in the old days did have its hazards, financially speaking. The actors in the old melodramas, popular in the first decades of this century, were often sustained solely by their enthusiasm for the job. They had to be, because frequently the ghost would forget to walk. Over 60 years ago, veteran actor Vivian Edwards toured from Melbourne to Perth in a makeshift company, the manager of which, he recalls, didn't enjoy paying the cast.
He didn't like to pay out money. It always seemed to hurt him. He'd say, "How much can you do with Mr. Edwards?" "Well," I said, "it's 4 bob from the pub and so on and so on. I want a drink." So then we pay it out, and he'd say, "There you are." He used to put up notices to say that the treasury will be after the show. Well, of course, he always pulled it down before the last act, and He put it up one night, and I said, what are you sticking that thing up for? You'd only put it down again. He said, you're very rude, Mr. Edwards. For 2 pins, I'd take the company back to Melbourne. I said, as much as you can do to get to the next town.
The actor on tour had to be ready to cover up when scenery went astray in transit or some minor calamity occurred, like on this occasion when the plot called for live pigeons.
The pigeons, of course, were the curtain. Rose, in the first act, immediately flew out into the audience and sat up on the chandeliers until the last act. And the last act, we were supposed to be miles out at sea. And I had a very beautiful reconciliation scene in the play with my long-lost husband, you know, clasped to his bosom. And that beautiful moment, one of the pigeons flew down and sat on my head. And I had very long hair, and the pigeon became entangled in this long hair. It was perfectly frightful. The hero had to disentangle the bird from my hair. And luckily he had a great sense of humor, and he said, ah, my dear, even the seabirds love you.
The actress with seabirds in her hair on that occasion was Agnes Dobson, who did her apprenticeship in melodrama, which reminds me that one of the greatest practitioners of melodrama was Edward Iram Coles, nicknamed the Bohemian because of his shoulder-length mane of hair. Coles' Bohemian players brought Wild West and Bushranger stories like Buffalo Bill and the Kelly Gang to audiences from Western Australia to Queensland. When talkies killed the touring melodramas, Coles, like other tent shows, switched to variety. Adding one or two pieces to their orchestras, they converted them at one stroke from on-track players into that mysterious body of men, the Pitt Band, whose weirdly evocative charm is the essence of show business. It's amazing to know how far into Australia the early shows went. Les Levant, how far west did you go?
In 1923, I took the first show overland from Perth in Western Australia to Broome. And that was quite a feat, I might tell you. And we played up through the back blocks, through Onslow, and in the dining rooms on turns. Push the tables together to make a stage. I recall the occasion when we arrived in Port Hedland and we were 3 days late getting there because the motor vehicle we had wasn't of the best. It was an old Ford that was getting stuck in the sand quite a lot. And when I arrived there and had a look, we got in there about 7 o'clock in the evening, and by the time we had some food and a shower and cleaned up a bit, the town was there. They said, well, what about the show? So I said, oh, what, tonight? It was in about 9 o'clock. They said, oh, yes, there's a lot of people in from the country, and some of them have come in 400 miles. So I went around and had a look at the hall, and there was no stage. So I said, oh, there's no stage. That's going to be a bit awkward. They said, oh, you want a stage? So a couple of trucks appeared. They went down to the railway yards, brought up sleepers, whilst another truck brought in hogsheads that had been used with beer. And before I knew where I was, the hogsheads had been upended, the sleepers were placed across them, and some tarpaulins from the railway had been spread over them, and we had a stage. So we started the show somewhere around about 10:30 and finished in the early hours of the morning. And I always recall the fact that I had a comedian with me named Monty Ford, an Englishman, a very, very funny man. We called him Rubber-Faced Ford. And keep in mind the fact that Ford Headland had never seen a show. And I remember a Chinese boy falling off a chair, shrieking with laughter. A boy, I mean a young man, about 20-odd years of age. So we did that show. The price in those days was 10 shillings for whites and 2 shillings for the Aboriginals. Anyhow, we played 4 nights there, and then I went on to Broome, and I stayed 3 months in Broome. I was there for the pearling layup.
In the same year that the Great Levant was bewildering the pearl fishers of Broome, one of the biggest city attractions was Australia's greatest vaudeville team of Stiffy and Moe.
I am the pirate king, I am a pirate. Hey! Awake, ye demons of the deep!
Who the hell's that, I wonder?
Don't you know me? I'm Pedro the pirate.
How do you do?
You know what a pirate is?
Yes.
What?
A fellow who picks up girls in Fitz Street.
No! Not that kind of a pirate.
No.
I'm a dirty, low-down, conniving sort of a pirate.
You look every inch of a two.
You know what I've done in the China Sea?
No.
I've taken a little baby girl, 6 months old.
Oh, that's young enough. You don't want any younger than that.
Thrown her overboard, and the sharks get them.
They don't do that in Sydney.
No.
Oh, no, they wait till they get about 18-year-olds, then the sharks get them.
The team of Stiffy and Moe came to life in 1916. Both performers were already well known, but they had never worked together. Nat Phillips and his wife Daisy Merritt had a double act, and Roy Rean, whose real name was Harry Vandersloos, was working as a single. They teamed up at the Princess Theatre, Sydney, and front of house man Bill Sadler came up with a name for the new partners.
I did not call Nat Phillips Stiffy. He had that name. But he handed me a photograph dressed up as a rabbit hole, and it had at the bottom Stiffy. So the matinee was coming on, so I thought I'd go around and see Roy Rean, see if he was going to have a nickname. And I said, Roy, what about a nickname as a photo with Stiffy on it? And he said, oh, well, Stiffy and Ikey, and he's putting on his Mo. So I said, what about Mo, Stiffy and Mo? He said, that'll do. So I come round the front and I rung up the printer and got it altered and it was Stiffy and Mo, and that's how he got his name.
The partnership of Stiffy and Mo flourished from the first, and after a decade of success, Roy Rean added to it by marrying Sadie Gale, daughter of comedian Sam Gale.
I first met Roy when I was with Fuller in New Zealand doing a double act with my mother. I don't remember too much about it. We've discussed it over the years, but I don't remember really much until he was doing an act with Fred Blewett, the late Fred Blewett. And I met him one day in the street with my mother, and really my mother was a great fan of Roy's, and they always used to laugh, and he used to always put on an act for my mother because she was a wonderful audience for him. And that was really the way I only remember meeting Roy. I was out at Newtown with Elton Black's company after having done a Hugh J. Ward show called The Rise of Rosie O'Reilly, and then I was told the next week when I went to rehearsal that I had to report for rehearsals with Stiffy and Mo, and I thought, what is this? And I remember walking up to the National Theatre that it was then, which is now the Mayfair, and he was standing on the curb talking to somebody. They just finished rehearsal, and I said, oh, Mr. Rean, could you tell me where I'd find Mr. Phillips? He said, yes, I think he's on the stage, love.
Roy Rean to this day has the reputation of having been a blue comedian, but people are fond of ascribing all kinds of jokes to him which he never, in fact, told. Was Roy so blue, Sadie?
Well, I suppose he was to a certain extent. But people said, Mo said this and Mo said that. He didn't. All he did was arch his eyebrows and give them the wink. It was up to them, as he said in his book. It was up to the audience the way they took it. It was their own minds. Mm. He didn't say it. And after all, Roy was a very quiet man. He was very narrow-minded. He was a very strict father, but he gave the public what they wanted. And after all, that was his living.
Sir, I'm bound.
What?
How?
No.
A eucalyptus, Peppy.
Well, I'll see what Mr. Lang can do.
Would you like a eucalyptus, baby? A eucalyptus, baby, like a you. Yes, I'd like a eucalyptus, baby, providing that it's not a chew. Would you nurse a eucalyptus, baby? You never know what it might do. If you'd like a eucalyptus, baby, I'll see what Mr. Lang can do.
In 1931, the drawing power of Moe at the box office clinched the success of the vaudeville revival of Mike Connors and Queenie Paul, who opened their theatre doors to Depression audiences hungry for laughter. Queenie Paul revives now a song she sang in the Haymarket Theatre, Sydney, in 1931. To survive, Australian performers have always had to be troopers in the real sense of the word. After Moe and Sadie Gale were married, they did a honeymoon tour into northern Queensland for Harry Clay, doing three-night stands as far north as Cairns, often playing in open-air theatres. Then they came back to the King's Melbourne for Frank Neil's show, Clowns in Clover. Opposite Roy in Clowns in Clover was the lugubrious comedian Hector Sinclair.
Never mind, if things look glum, you're sure to find there's worse to come. That behind the silver lining, there are black clouds overhead. Da-da-da-da, so there's no doubt, when up the spout, tomorrow you'll be down and out. But there's this consolation that you'll soon be dead.
I have some more joyful tidings like that. I am the happiest corpse in the morgue as I jump from slab to slab. Ooh, cut that out, that's rotten. Stop that coughing. Now we'll rehearse. That's good. Coughing, curse, and put some body into this. There is no fun in a cemetery, so give me my flowers now. Written by George Graves. My father had no whiskers, so he grew some.
Hector Sinclair was one of the few of the older Australian performers who made records. Most of them sang their songs live, and that's the only way the public heard them. Charlie Lawrence reminds us.
In those days, remember, no radio, even no gramophones. And we were the people who introduced the new songs, the popular songs. They were a darn sight better than what they call popular songs today, but we introduced them. Things like, I'm thinking of popular ones, Won't You Come Home, Bill Bailey, Ragtime Cowboy Joe, that was a popular one. They liked that in the country, and the other ragtime, Alexander's Ragtime Band.
Managers who took shows out back had boundless courage and enthusiasm, as did the performers with them, like Bert LeBlanc.
They took the town hall at Rockhampton. Well, they had no scenery. Newton, Billy Carroll, he loaned them a bit of scenery, another big good tent man who's passed on, and he always was a lovely fellow too, the same Billy Carroll. He loaned them some scenery. And they borrowed a couple of tabs somewhere from the local dancing teacher. And we had got the local ballet from Rockhampton. Of course, they couldn't rehearse till the laundry's let out at about 6 o'clock. And they got the local contralto. The acrobats were comics. And Les Levant was my feeder. And they got a Sue Brett come along there, and she tried out, and I said, "What do you do?" She says, I sing, "I'm waiting for ships that never come in." And after I heard her, I says, "The ships don't come in here either." During the daytime, she was on the showground, and they threw knives at her head. I don't know how they ever missed. But however, She was the soubrette. Well, we went on there, and that night, the first night, the curtain went up. One of the owners had threepence in his pocket, and the other fella had a zack. They had ninepence between them. And that opening night, on my word of honor, there were £65 in the house.
And £65 represented wealth. One of the comedy teams to tour North Queensland was Joe Brennan and Ida Newton with Branscombe's Dandies. Joe was at his funniest with a battered helmet and a uniform as a rather reluctant fireman.
"Go on, you kids, get away from there. Lean up against the fire station. He'll have it over in a minute."
Excuse me. Is this the fire station?"
"Of course it's the fire station."
"Well, I represent the Daily Mail, and my editors asked me to write a leading article on all the fire stations of the state."
"Of course it's the fire station you want."
"Of course it's the fire station I want."
"We've often been taken for window cleaners, you know."
"First of all, I should like to see the engine."
"Now, come away from here. Come away. It's only tied up with string."
"Oh, gracious me."
"We got a third hand from war, you all. After I had an accident with it. Sometimes when they're not busy, I run it out and have a ride on it." "Come over here. You don't seem to understand. Now, when that bell rings, I answer the phone, and then I put that plug in there."
"And what does that do?"
"Oh, well, it doesn't do anything, but it looks so untidy hanging down." "No, you see, the houses are so small here, they burn down before we ever get there."
"Yes." "Well, then, what's the good of you?"
"Oh, I don't know. We look very nice in a procession. They usually put us in between the journalists and the temperance union."
"Well, now, I should like to see inside that engine."
"Now, come away from here. Come away. You'll frighten me in."
"What?"
"I've got a couple of ends sitting in there."
"You don't tell me that."
"Well, what does it matter when we're not busy?"
"Now, tell me, when did you receive your last call?"
"Well, about a few months ago, we got a call to say there's a top of the hill, and I calls out the corpse."
"Pardon me, that word is pronounced core."
I always call it corpse. Means a body of men, don't it?
Now, which was the biggest fire you ever had?
Well, the biggest fire we ever had was the public baths. All we had to do was to push the burning building into the baths and go home. Hello. There, telephone. Hello? Yes? I know all about that, but we can't come at a moment's notice, you know. I'll tell you what to do. You write into me, and I'll give you a form to fill up. And then I'll put it before the council. And if we're not busy, we'll come. What's that? The top story's gone. Oh, good, good. We won't need the ladders now. Eh? What street did you say it was? Oh, we never go down that street. Now, is there anything else you'd like to know, miss?
Certainly not. It's a disgrace. Fancy a fire station like this in 1963. It's a disgrace, man. And you, I say, just look at you. There you stand when you hear that bell calling you to save life and property. You should be ready, man. Ready, up and away.
Oh, that settles it. Horace, get those ends out. I'm a fireman. I've told you that before. And now you know I'm a fireman, I won't tell you anymore.
During World War II, a new version of the touring shows was born with the Army Entertainment Units under Lieutenant Colonel Jim Gerald, who brought all his experience as a comedian into organizing shows for the troops. Army shows played anywhere there were enough soldiers to make up an audience, as George Wallace Jr. recalls.
When we went out as what they call troubadour shows. Hmm. They split the show up. That would possibly be the comic, a magician, and an accordion player would go to one area, then a singer and another instrumentalist to another area, and there we would just go out, whether it be in a jeep or sometimes in those army ducks, we would go across the water, out to these outposts. We did a show one night, and I remember there were only six of us, and we were working, and we weren't allowed to have any lights, of course. They said, no lights. I said, how are they going to see? And he said, well, if you speak, the lieutenant or colonel in charge said, if you speak in a very soft voice, he said, we'll get pretty close to you. And it was an experience, and he said, every now and again, he said, if you can just wave, give a little wave, he said, up towards the hills up there, he said, I would appreciate it. So we did the show, and I put in a few waves here and there. And when it was over, I said, well, some of our boys are up there. He said, oh, no, the Japs are up there. I said, you mean to say they're Japanese? He said, well, he said, they have field glasses. He said, and there's enough light from the few cars that are on you now. He said, and they watch the entertainment. He said, and we wave to them now and again. I said, what about the fighting? He said, well, as soon as something lets fly, he said, it's on again. But he said, but after that, we wave to each other.
Another comedian who entertained wartime audiences was Max Reddy with his wife Stella Lamond. For the last 12 years, they've been taking shows each year to tour Tasmania. Like all entrepreneurs, they've had good years and bad years.
You've got to be very careful what towns you go to, when you go and how you know, because you'll always find that Mrs. Jones had a yucca party the night before you got there.
Oh, what about the year we had the fire?
Oh, gosh.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, we had a fire one year and lost everything. Lost all the wardrobe and everything between Queenstown and Launceston. That was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We never had one costume for the girls. Gasbrock's
xylophone
was half burnt, and we went on at 8 o'clock. We went round all the amateur companies, and we borrowed curtains, and we borrowed couple of little outfits, and the girls put a blue bow on this and a pink bow for the next number and a yellow bow for the next number. We got through the show, okay?
The stage
door... We went up
door,
at a minute past eight.
Yes. The stage door was absolutely inundated with people coming in and saying, I believe you've had a fire and you haven't got any wardrobe.
Well,
my Elsie, she's got some nice little frocks there. You can borrow those with pleasure. And everybody in Launceston seemed to rally round. Up went the curtain.
Marvellous, wasn't it? Mm.
Audiences for touring shows like their humour broad and their music tuneful, and they relish this sort of song routine.
I love that city.
I love the city where the girls are very pretty and I love the lights on the town.
I love that city.
I love the hustle and the bustle and the trifle and I love to hear the rustle of a gown.
I seem to hear.
I love the ladies and I'm always playing handies and I'm gonna make a shine. I'm gonna buy a wine. The sky's the limit and we'll trim it to the minute. For I tell you one, the life will look will be the very devil's own. And all the places where we see the pretty faces, where there's music and laughter and song.
And where the sun
we won't go home till morning till the break of day is dawning. So come on along, come on along.
I miss that
a
way.
A daily or a mini or a pretty little family walking on the Piccadilly makes me act a little silly. I forget about the dear old home of mine.
Without doubt, the best-known roadshow in Australia is Sawley's, which is touring again this year under new management. George Sawley began it during the First World War, playing melodrama. He was a fine performer, actor, comedian, acrobat, and singer, with a wistful charm all his own.
You may not be an angel, 'cause angels are so few. But until the day that one comes along, I'll string along with you. I'm looking for an angel sing my love song to. And until the day that one comes along, I'll sing my song to you. For every little fault that you have, say I've got three or four. The human little faults you do have just make me love you. You may not be an angel, but still I'm sure you'll do. So until the day that one comes along, I'll string along with you.
Nobody has an ill word to say of George Sawley. All his contemporaries agree he was a fine performer, a great showman, and a gentleman. After Sawley's death in 1948, comedian Bobby Lebrun became part owner of the show with Mrs. Grace Sawley.
One of the interesting sights was at Bundaberg. We used to call it the Battle of Bundaberg. The entire bank of the river was reserved for tent shows, and they used to be almost peg to peg. And on one year there, I think it was about 1933 or 34, there was no less than nine tents. There was that year there was Barton's Follies, Sawley's, a show called The Cameos, I think it was Tommy Henley's Buck Jump Show, Perry Circus with two tents, an animal tent and the Mo Big Top, Stanley Mackay, and Coles Varieties, and they were all on this one allotment, almost peg to peg. And the entire population of Bundaberg used to go down onto the riverbank, and they all had megaphones, and each show had a band playing outside. It was a wonderful sight, probably unique in the world. And each one calling out, this is the best show, and this way to the show, you know. There were no loudspeakers in the early days, of course. And George Sawley stole a march on them. One year at the Battle of Bundaberg, he produced the first public address system. We'd seen this big box hidden away in the dressing room all through the term. We all wondered what it was, and he said, you'll find out later. And he produced it in Bundaberg, and that year he swamped all the speakers with their megaphones right out of business. Of course, next year they all turned up with PA systems, but George had the first one.
Even Sawley's competitors on the road were friendly competitors. Here's what Stanley Mackay, Charlie Lawrence, and the great Levant thought of him.
George used to say, we'd both announce each other's shows, and I remember one night in Orange, he was announcing my show, and he said, you know, Stanley and I are our only enemies between 7 and 8 o'clock at night. That's when our bell ringers were out telling them all about what wonderful shows we had, you see.
I was burnt out in Adelaide, went up to Broken Hill.
And we arrived there on the Friday to open on the Saturday. George had a big tent show there. We went to see it. Cutting it short, he called me up onto the platform. And he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the finest show you have ever seen in Broken Hill opens here tomorrow night at the Crystal Palace." Now, don't forget, he was still showing in the town the next night. He said, "Whatever you do, not only go yourself, but take your friends. And don't miss this." Now, I wonder, would you find that camaraderie among show people today?
Oh, George and I were great friends. I had known George from the early days of Harry Clay in the Clay Theatres here in Sydney, and George was a very, very good performer and a charming gentleman. And he came from Liverpool. Well, as I tell you, George offered me his touring tent outfit before ever I bought the Igloo for £6,000, and I should have bought it because I could have bought the Sawley name, their storeroom in Balmain, their two tents, the everything. George was interested in building that village called Sawleyville over on the north side of the harbour, and he thought that he wouldn't have to bother about touring anymore, and he was quite right too. Unfortunately, the Sawleyville thing didn't turn out quite the way he expected, but it has since, of course, and poor George developed a coronary and he passed out. I think that it would be quite safe to say that George Sawley would be perhaps the master of touring theatres. He knew every angle to it. He had he'd grown up with it from Philip Lytton. Philip Lytton was the one of the earliest touring fellows with canvas, and he ran dramatic shows. And he engaged George to play the part of Uncle Tom in Uncle Tom's Cabin, which George was quite successful too. And when Philip Lytton went out of the business, George carried on doing dramatic shows. Then when the drama fell down, which would be caused, of course, from the influx of the cinema, then George switched it over to a variety show.
Tiny little toes, a turned up shiny little nose. To me she's mighty like a rose, and everybody knows she's beautiful. Yes, beautiful. Mighty hard to make, but doggone mighty good to take. The day that she belongs to me, I'm going to try and be so beautiful. She's got a marvelous this and such a wonderful that. Just wait until you see. She's a little bit good and a little bit bad, but she's first class company. I'm going to get a ring. We'll see the parson in the spring. The bells will ting-a-ling-a-ling, cause every little thing will be beautiful. Did it remind you of somebody, huh? I'll tell you some more. Oh, boy, talk about joy. I'm just running wild. Ever since I fell in love with this gorgeous child. I've heard a lot about happiness, but never knew till she said yes. I'll tell the world that I know now. Am I glad and how? Tiny little toes, a turned up shiny little nose. To me, she's mighty like a rose, and everybody knows she's beautiful, yes, beautiful. Mighty hard to make, but doggone mighty good to take. The day that she belongs to me, I'm going to try and be so beautiful. She's got a marvelous this and such a wonderful that. Just wait until you see. She's a little bit good and just a little bit bad, but she's first class company. I'm going to get a ring. We'll see the parson in the spring. The wedding bells will ting-a-ling, and every little thing will be beautiful. Yes, beautiful. B-E-A-U-T-I-F-U-L spells beautiful.
But I do want to impress upon you that those early shows were a very big thing in the life of this country. They did a lot. They were the one break many little towns got once maybe in 6 months, and how they look forward to and how good they were to you. But do remember that when you think of what's here today. Remember the job that those early people did.
The story of the touring shows in Australia was written by John West and Charles Graham, The voices of the pioneer showman and artist were introduced by John West, and Fair Dinkum Variety was produced in Sydney for the Australian Broadcasting Commission by Charles Graham.